This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. There was a time in the 80s and 90s when we were hearing a lot about anorexia and bulimia. The death of singer Karen Carpenter from anorexia opened a public dialogue about the seriousness of eating disorders. But that discussion seems to have faded, while a focus on thinness and fitness remains strong in popular culture. But the National Eating Disorders Association says 30 million Americans suffer from a clinically significant eating disorder at some time in their life. No, the problem has not gone away. Filmmaker Bess O'Brien's previous film, The Hungry Heart, pulled back the curtain on opiate addiction. Her latest film, All of Me, by Kingdom County Productions, does the same with eating disorders. Here's a clip from All of Me.
She doesn't eat her breakfast. She doesn't eat her lunch. And she doesn't eat supper. And the next day, she doesn't eat breakfast. And she refused to eat for 11 days. In 11 days, she ate one pea.
We watch her weight going, you know, first it goes down a half a pound, then it goes up half of it, but gradually it's a downward slide.
November, December, her weight kind of kept going down incrementally, a little.
I would get really sick and she'd see like double and here. And I felt like athletically, I was not doing as well. I was getting weaker, but ironically, I thought it was because I was too overweight.
I still saw this like 200-pound person in the mirror. I didn't see bones. I didn't see like a sunken-in face. I didn't see like these really just like eyes that were void of any life. I didn't see what people were telling me that they saw.
Her heart rate was down in the 30s. Her period stopped. She was extremely moody, you know, and I could see every bone in her body.
When you see your child so like a skeleton, it's terrifying. When we were in New York, people would walk up to her and say, oh, you must be a model, which made it even more horrific.
That's from the new Vermont-made documentary, All of Me, and filmmaker Bess O'Brien joins us in the studio today. Also with us is Bree Greenberg-Benjamin, a psychotherapist and founder of the Vermont Center for Integrative Therapy, which is featured in the film. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
That was really a tough piece of audio to listen to. It pulls back the curtain a bit on how destructive these illnesses can be. Bess O'Brien, what prompted you to make this film?
Well, actually, the first voice that you heard in that clip was of a father. His name is Norm. And I was touring my last film, The Hungry Heart, through Vermont. I was at the Vergennes Opera House. This was about 3 years ago. And I came out of the screening, and there was Norm standing there. And he said, you know, I love The Hungry Heart. Thank you so much. I'm just wondering if you would consider your next movie to be on eating disorders. And I thought, eating disorders, wow, you know, I haven't, sort of like what you were saying, I haven't really thought about that for a while. And I said, do you have a personal story connected to it? And he said, yes, my daughter, you know, ever since she was a little girl, has been struggling with an eating disorder. And it is just so debilitating. It is such a hidden issue, and many parents feel completely alone in struggling with it. There's not enough resources to deal with it, and we're just not talking about it as a community. And, you know, I would just plead with you to think about making your next movie about this topic. And then he said, and, you know, maybe you could come and meet Bree Greenberg-Benjamin, who runs the Vermont Center for Integrative Therapy in Burlington, because she worked with my daughter and she knows a lot about eating disorders. And maybe after you talk to her, you'd be more interested. And so I actually ended up going and talking to Bree, and found her very exceptional and knowledgeable. And we had a really great talk, and next thing I knew, I was making the movie.
Well, Bree Greenberg-Benjamin, a misconception that you hear is if she would just eat, then the problem would be solved. This is what I would think. But you say eating disorders are not about food. So what are they about?
Well, I say eating disorders aren't about food. It's when I say that, it doesn't mean that food isn't a component of eating disorders, most certainly. And often the thing that has to happen first is weight restoration or some sort of biochemical process of restoration so that people can think straight enough to be able to really do the deeper work. But I think the misnomer is that they're all about food. Yeah. And that when you start eating again, or if you stop purging, or if you stop overeating, that you're better. And actually, a lot of times, even when those symptoms stop, what really grew the eating disorder in the first place gets buried even deeper. And those kinds of things are deep sense of shame, inadequacy, self-hatred, lots of times trauma. It's different for every person, but a lot of anxiety, a lot of deep sensitivity with the world, and the sensitivity brings up these parts that feel like they're really scared to be in the world.
So terms that I heard again for the first time in years were anorexia and bulimia. So just remind people again of those differences.
So typical anorexia is where you restrict food, and there's no overeating or purging going on. Bulimia is where you're not necessarily restricting food, although you can restrict some food, and then you wind up either getting rid of that through laxative use, over-exercise, throwing up, those kinds of things.
And when you're working with a patient, does it matter now if it's bulimia or anorexia?
It really doesn't. And actually, over the last decade or so, I would say you see very little of straight anorexia, or we've seen less of that. And a lot more of people kind of vacillating between different types of behaviors. So it's almost like the individual will starve for a while, and then the body gets really tired of starving, or that deprivation becomes too much. And then you start eating again, but that eating feels like a purge, like it feels like a lot if you haven't eaten. And so then the desire to throw up comes in to eliminate the food, and then there's a period of bulimia that ensues. And so there's a lot of fluctuations that happen for people. And the truth of the matter is, it really doesn't matter. It matters more medically than it does really from a psychological or energetic stance of treating etiology.
Mm-hmm. Bess O'Brien, the film has a few dozen people in it, and they are telling their stories or the stories of their children. What are some of the underlying causes that came up for the people that you interviewed?
Well, I mean, I think as Bree said, what was interesting to me and what I was interested in pursuing is what is underneath all this, right?
Right.
What are the systemic reasons for eating disorders? And for me, I mean, many of my films, I think, have a similar theme, which is whether we use drugs or opiates or food to soothe ourselves, to calm ourselves, or to cover up things that we really don't want to deal with, whether it's trauma in our life, whether it's anxiety, depression, mental health issues. And, you know, food, as Bree says, I think, in the movie, is everywhere. And so it's a way of controlling what feels out of control in many ways. And so, you know, the people in the film are extremely articulate about growing up with certain anxieties or depressions that never got resolved, that they never really dealt with, and then used food to sort of try to handle that. But of course it doesn't, because you're not really dealing with the root of the problem. And so it just sort of snowballs into a mess, you know. And so really, I would say that, you know, I think Bree would agree, is that, you know, recovery, if we want to use that word, is really about going back to what is the root of the problem, and looking at that and resolving that and healing that. That is really what you need to do in order to get through an eating disorder. Yes, you need to eat and get stable and have a healthy weight gain or whatever. But, you know, you also have to deal with what is really hurting you and work through that.
Listeners, what experience do you and your families have with eating disorders like anorexia and bulimia? And what questions do you have about the causes, the effects, the recovery from eating disorders? You can call 1-800-639-2211. It's 1-800-639-2211 to join the conversation, or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Bree Greenberg-Benjamin, I was surprised by this stat in the film, that 42% of female athletes in sports have eating disorders. That was shocking to me. Where is that line that you cross from eating to win to eating to thin?
I think it's a really fine line, and the discernment between which side of that line you're on has more to do with your intention than has to do with really what your behaviors are. So it has to do with whether or not you're doing it because you feel a sense of emptiness or a lot of fear around if you don't do it, you're not going to win or you're not going to be good enough. That's going to drive a lot of those behaviors. If you're not feeling that, then you're really just doing it for the sport, which is a very different mindset and tends to have much more flexibility around it and a lot less fear.
Bess O'Brien, you used the word control, and it's used by a lot of people in this film when they're discussing their eating disorder. So explain how that concept of control works, that they want control.
Well, I mean, I think that what they talk about in the movie is you know, with bulimia, for instance, you know, the idea of you want to, you eat, and part of that eating is also, I mean, we all know that. Like, we all overeat or binge or eat a bunch of cookies when we're feeling crappy, right? Right. I mean, anybody can relate to that. But then in these cases, you start to feel guilty and shamed to the point where you can't handle it, essentially. And so you throw it up. And so that is a control mechanism. It's like, I'm not a bad person because I'm throwing up now. I've got it under control. Even if I eat a lot of cookies or go out and binge on something, that, you know, then if I throw it up, then I'm okay. But actually, even after that, you don't feel good about yourself and you get into a retreat. I mean, it's like addiction. You know, the first couple times you do it, you think, oh, yeah, this feels great. You know, I've got this under control. I can just do 5 pills or whatever. But, you know, as you go along in your addiction and you get more addicted, all the things, you know, things get out of control. And certainly, Bree, why don't you talk about anorexia and the control around that? I mean, there's tons of control.
Yeah, I mean, I think with anorexia, a lot of it has to do with a sense of deprivation. And so there's a mindset that deprivation leads to actually a lot of self-inflation. So, you know, you kind of start to think of yourself as being different or better than other people. Mm-hmm. And that can really combat a lot of that inner sense of inadequacy that's there and can be something that can be really hard to get at as well, because it seems like you're a victim. But in another sense, you're trying to rescue yourself from that victimhood by being in the one-up position with everybody else in your life and in the world. So it's pretty tricky.
But there's that idea of control working to a point, and then the person kind of loses control in this this addiction or you know, the idea of this disorder. It begins to control them. So how does that happen? Where does that switch, Bree?
Right. Well, there's that sense of it from at the beginning, it's about ordering the outside world because that feels really unsafe. And the truth of the matter is that's the truth for all of us, which is that the world is pretty unsafe on some level. Things happen all the time and we don't really have full control over that. And when you start to feel into that, there's a lot of fear that arises. So for these folks, they may have had either just more of a setup in their body and mind to be fearful, or they may have had bad things happen that have told their body and mind, you should be fearful and not safe in the world. And so it moves from trying to control the external world to at some point realizing that they no longer have a handle over that. And now it's turned on them. And when that happens, you see a very different presentation. Instead of seeing somebody who feels pretty empowered, you see somebody who feels very young and disempowered and feels like now this thing that is no longer feels like it's in them but is out of them and is a part of them, they can no longer get any space or break from.
And yet it's very difficult for them to kind of identify that they've lost the control, that it's now controlling them.
Right.
So how does someone understand that it has happened?
Well, I think part of the goal in that is understanding that an individual has become very fractured at that point. So parts of them that used to be either incorporated or used to have a small role in their system have now taken on a very big role in their system. And other parts of them are being overshadowed by that. So if you start to look at the fragmentation, not as a bad thing, but just as things getting out of balance, then you begin to look at like how things can become more whole again. So nothing needs to like leave or be be gone. It just needs to maybe shift a little bit so that there's some more balance going on. And understanding why it became out of balance is some of how that shift happens. So that can be a lot of deep healing work that has to happen before and through that understanding of why it got so out of balance.
Listeners, we're discussing eating disorders and a new film called All of Me. You can join the discussion at 1-800-639-2211. Let's hear from Fred, who's calling from Montreal. Fred, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Hello. So I want to share with you my experience. My daughter, who is 16 and a half and is in the last year of high school, has been with this anorexic condition for over a year, and she's been under treatment both by a specialist and a psychological counselor at the same institution. And we've more or less gotten her eating back to a normal state. But the problem is the following. Just as you said earlier, notwithstanding the fact that she's an A-plus student, she's a head ambassador for her school, she's been made the producer of her dance show, which she's been looking forward to for the past 4 years. She doesn't want to exert her authority because she's afraid of what other people will think of her. She is worried that she won't be invited to the after party at the prom, and she thinks that by getting a beautiful dress from New York City, everybody will think that she's beautiful and it will be all right. And I want to tell her that the dress is not going to make any difference at all. And I was wondering if you had any kind of ideas about this.
Fred, may I just ask you a question? How are you dealing with it? How are you handling things?
Very badly, I must say. I can't understand because when I look at her and all the support my wife and I have given her, oh, I forgot to mention, the way I found out about her anorexia a year and a half ago was that there was a casual mention among between my daughter and my wife in passing that she didn't have her menstrual period for a while. And that, of course, made my ears perk up, and we took her to her pediatrician, and then I pushed to get a specialist, and that's how the whole treatment started, and that's how she was diagnosed. I'm taking it very badly to answer your question, because I look at all the support my wife and I have given her both since her early childhood, and here she is with all these feelings of inadequacy, and I just don't understand how this happened.
Well, Fred, thank you so much for sharing that. You know, I hear what he's saying about a super achiever, an overachiever. We hear that so much in the film All of Me, and we see it in these beautiful young people. They are doing so well in different areas, and for some reason, this eating disorder happens. Bree?
I would just say that the combination of overcompensation and ability and capability is some of what makes that come into play. So these are typically women who are sensitive enough to be very capable of a lot of different stuff. They're really talented. And so when you don't feel so great about yourself, which often happens and arises just from being sensitive in the world, you know, if you're attuned to what's going on with other people's reactions, you're going to notice micro reactions from people around you. And the story you may tell yourself from those micro reactions is that it's about you. And as a child, we all think the world is about us. And the difference, I think, is that when you see micro reactions, those feel very big to you. They don't feel micro. They feel like the truth. And so you develop this internal narrative that says that this is the truth about who you are and that you need to overcompensate from that by exceeding in these other ways. And it's kind of the chicken or the egg type of thing where the more you try to exceed, you never get that carrot that's out in front of you. It never makes you feel full enough, so to speak.
And Bess O'Brien, these are very personal stories that we're hearing in the film, and we need to hear those to kind of drive home the point. But how do you know when the line is met where you're not revealing too much information of the people who are telling their stories?
Well, I guess what my comment to that would be that if they're telling me their stories in the 1.5 to 2 hour interview that I'm doing with them, then it's okay to use whatever they say. I mean, you know, I get asked a lot about this in my films about how did you get people to open up and talk so intimately about their stories. And, you know, these are very intense issues. And I have never had any problem getting people to tell me their stories. I think that when you get to a place of saying to a film director, I want to be in your movie, I think you're at a place that you want to talk. I mean, I even hear it in this father who just called in. He needs to talk about this. He needs somebody to talk about this because you feel alone. And you also, I think, for a lot of the people in my films, and certainly in this one, they're at a place in their process with whatever they're struggling with that they want to help other people. They want to reach out. They want to go to another level in their healing process. And part of that is letting their story be public and to connect with audiences and to help this father and to tour with the movie and have conversations with audiences. So, you know, yes, I obviously feel very beholden to these people. I feel very committed to telling their story in a truthful way. I feel very honored that they opened up and were so brave to share these stories with me. And all I can do is try to make the best movie. I would just say to the father that he and his wife should get some support group, right? They need, because that's the other thing that also happens a lot, is that we look at the person who is the victim or the person who is dealing with the issue. And that is very important, but we forget about the family around them, and the family needs a lot of support, and they get majorly impacted by these diseases. So I would say to the father, please try to find a support group or a therapist. Maybe he has one to help you through understanding what's going on with your daughter.
And coming up next, we will discuss the effect that eating disorders can have on families and relationships. We're talking about eating disorders and the new film from Kingdom County Productions, All of Me. To share your thoughts or ask a question, you can call us at 1-800-639-2211, or you can post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri, and this is Vermont Edition. You might not have been hearing people talk about eating disorders for some time now, but they still exist and are still having a devastating effect on individuals and their families. Listeners, if you or someone in your family has experienced an eating disorder, you can share your story or call in with a question. Our number is 1-800-639-2211, 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Filmmaker Bess O'Brien has released a new documentary about eating disorders called All of Me. It begins showing around the state next week. Today, we're speaking with Bess O'Brien and with Bree Greenberg-Benjamin, a psychotherapist and founder of the Vermont Center for Integrative Therapy, which is featured in the film. Here's a clip from All of Me in which parents describe wanting to intervene to help their children.
You really have to think before you say something, because the automatic things that a parent would say to a child who hasn't eaten enough,
right. You
can't do that.
It goes against every fiber in your body as a mother to not feed your child.
You're watching somebody not eat enough that I've spent my life feeding this child. And I knew what I should and shouldn't say. And ultimately, I failed. Whenever she was home for a long period of time, I couldn't stop myself from saying, Olivia, that's not enough.
From a parent's perspective, it's incredibly difficult because you don't know what to do.
I don't know what to do. I just don't know what to do. This is all we talk about. This is all we do. This is a living hell.
It is hard to talk about it because sometimes you wonder as the mom, like, did I do something wrong? Like, is it my, like, you're like, is it my fault?
That's from the new documentary, All of Me, which deals with eating disorders. Bree Greenberg-Benjamin, one thing the families struggle with is, first, how to identify if it is an eating disorder. So how do they? What do you look for?
Well, there's a lot of different things that we might screen for as far as medically, where are people, where's their thought process. And sometimes it's a really fine line to identify, is it really an eating disorder? And what does that really mean? I mean, we have a DSM criteria for eating disorders that we can go through the questions and find out if it's a fit. But I think more importantly for me, what I'm looking for is finding out how much of this person's existence is taken up by thinking about, planning for, obsessing with either food, their body, other people's reaction to them. Those are the things that stand out for me.
Yeah, but how do I, as a parent with a son or daughter, not doing the screening, not asking the important questions that you know to ask, how do I identify if it is an eating disorder? I mean, 11 days with one pee, we heard earlier.
Yes.
Okay, there you would know. But some of the other examples in the film, it would be very difficult as a parent to understand. So how? What should they do?
It is really difficult to identify as a parent, I think, because eating disorders live and thrive in secrecy. And people who struggle with eating disorders are really, really good at keeping that secret.
As a matter of fact, one woman said they should be in the CIA or something.
Right. So, I mean, it's not to say that even if you know what to look for, that you're necessarily going to see it. But I think secretive behavior and allowing sometimes as a parent some of your curiosity and your gut to speak can be really helpful. I think it also has to do with what your connection is with your kid. You know, do you have a sense of like where your child is at and what they're struggling with? Is there time to really connect about life and difficulty, whether it be peer difficulty or their internal difficulty of growing up and just moving through life?
Now, Bess, the parents you interviewed were very honest. They were very emotional. What were the themes that came up again and again from those parents watching their children struggle with these disorders?
Well, I think exactly what you're trying to get at, which is that this disease is a heck of a conundrum. I mean, it is really tough because, first of all, trying to decipher if your daughter has an eating disorder. And then once they have it, you know, this whole idea is that what a parent wants to do is they want to feed their kids. They want to feed their kids. And the minute that you start pushing them to eat, they retract and they get defensive and they throw things across the table and leave the room. And so it's like one of those excruciating dances where you have to sort of step back and like not talk about the food and not talk about the weight, even though you're scared to death. It's a very complicated disease. I mean, this for me as a filmmaker, this was one of the hardest films I had to make because eating disorders are extremely complicated. In my opinion, in some ways, more complicated than a drug addiction.
It's hard to watch. And I struggled when the parents didn't know what to say. So, Bree, what to say?
Well, before I say that, I would just say that, you know, what really is happening here is that everybody in the family is struggling with a core sense of helplessness. So the rage that parents feel and the frustration comes from feeling into that helplessness of, I can't fix this for my kid. And of course, ironically, the kid is feeling like they can't fix it for themselves either. So circulating through this whole family system is this sense of helplessness. And on the other side of helplessness, what we try to mitigate that with is control. So parents then try to control the food of their kids. Kids are trying to control their external world. And you've got this energy moving through the entire system that nobody is really relenting with. It becomes very circular, very encapsulating, and often mirrors the way the parents grew up or history for them energetically and psychologically. So it's very hard to break that.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones and talk to Neville. He's calling from Montpelier. Neville, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. So a note of hope, I was bulimic for 25 years, like severely, as in binging and purging sometimes all day and into the night. But I'm 12 years in recovery now.
Great.
Wow, fantastic. Well, so Neville, it's a great point, great voice to hear because I'm watching most of the film and it was all women. And then finally you included a young boy who had an eating disorder. So it's not just men. I mean, sorry, not just women who this affects. Right, Bess O'Brien?
No. And I don't know. Probably Bree knows the statistics perhaps more than I. But anyway, maybe she doesn't. But the point is that, you know, over the last 20 or 30 years, we have seen a rise in males having eating disorders. Is this guy still on the line?
No.
Okay. Anyway, Neville, thank you for calling in because I think it's really, really important to say that, no, it's not just women and girls. It's boys. And talk about shaming and talk about secrecy. I mean, it's one thing for a young woman to admit that she has an eating disorder. But man, it is hard for boys to do that. And we have this wonderful young boy in the film. God bless him. So yeah. courageous to come out and talk yeah. in front of the camera. And so, you know, I mean, I guess the other thing that I would just put out there is, to me, the film is about eating disorders in quotations. Yes, it is about that. But I also think it's about eating, how all of us deal with food, how all of us deal with our body image. I don't think there is any woman who will sit through this movie who doesn't relate to most of what people are talking about, even if they haven't had a, quote, eating disorder. Because, you know, if you're living in the society, you know all the media focus on body image and the way you look and how we use food. And there's also a section in the film, as Bree pointed out, about food in the family and how we grow up with how food is used for both control by our parents around food or punishment or whatever, all these things we pick up. So I think that, you know, everyone can learn something from these people in the movie about their own lives and about, as a society, how we see food and body and also mental health, because it's very much about mental health, too.
We have a call from Wallingford. Chris is calling. Thanks for joining us today on Vermont Edition, Chris.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling from the experience of a father who has a daughter who is recovering from anorexia, an eating disorder. And, yes, it's a feeling of complete helplessness. And one of the issues that was compounded that sense of helplessness for us was, one, finding treatment for her, effective treatment for her, and two, getting insurance companies to pay for that treatment. What we found was that the insurance companies would pay for treatment for either 21 days or till she reached a certain BMI, which was rather minimal. And it's easy to get someone to meet a minimal BMI by forcing them to eat in a very controlled environment. And once they reach that BMI, they are discharged as being, quote-unquote, healthy, back into trying to manage their own life. And that is completely ineffective.
Yep.
We were fortunate in that my wife's employer was partially self-employed, self-insured. And so after some frustrating period, they stepped up to the plate and said, we will pay for long-term treatment for her. And that paid off. It was a family-based treatment. We were all involved. And she is now one of the happiest people I know. And I'll just take the comments offline. Thanks.
Great. Chris, thank you so much for sharing those comments and that story. Let's talk about treatment first of all, Bree. What are the most common treatments for eating disorders?
There's a range of treatments for eating disorders, from at the top of the range, then the most intensive being inpatient hospitalization. That's where somebody's getting refed or their bodies are being restored to being healthy enough to continue treatment. Underneath that, you would have residential treatment, and then there'd be a partial hospitalization program under that, an intensive outpatient program under that, and then just regular outpatient teams that get together under that.
Now, your practice, you take a very holistic approach to treatment. So give us an idea of how you deal with a client who has an eating disorder, knowing that no two are alike.
Yeah, I would just say that we take a pretty multidisciplinary approach more than it is holistic.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody is different, but essentially we're always looking to combine some form of body-based work with the work that's going on with talk therapy as well. And then we're making sure that somebody is medically stable. If they don't already have a doc, we're providing them with that. And we're looking at brain chemistry. We're looking at energetics. We're looking at family history. We're looking at trauma history. So essentially what we're trying to do is have this target in front of us of somebody's wholeness and looking at what are the occlusions to that wholeness. And we're going to be looking at what obstacles are in the way to that and removing those obstacles. And some of them may demand talking about things and going back in the past or not at all. Some may demand a certain sense of focus, so there might be meditation or yoga included. Some may demand changing what's happening energetically in the body, so we might use an energy worker, an acupuncturist, to really realign what's happening, the perpetual schemas and cycles that people hold in their bodies and then in their minds.
Now, another important issue that Chris brought up was the insurance. Mm-hmm. Paying for this is, it's not inexpensive, as we learn in the film. So is insurance paying for enough of this? I know this is a difficult question.
Well, I will be diplomatic and say no. but honestly, I think insurance isn't paying for enough of it because what's needed is so much. So, I think that we really are scratching the surface, as Chris indicated. And, you know, generally when I send people to residential treatment, I'm hoping they can get at least 6 months of that. And then they could get a step down program after that. So, you know, you're really looking at something that's very ingrained in somebody's system and either has been only ingrained in their system, but most often is also ingrained in their family legacy. Those are not things that change quickly or easily.
So, Bess O'Brien, All of Me, your new film, were you surprised when you started to research it at what you found about the eating disorders that are going on in Vermont?
I was quite amazed that it's interesting because people come up to me and say, what's your next movie? And when I would say, I'm shooting this film on eating disorders, almost everybody said, oh, yeah, you know, my sister, my brother, me. Oh, yeah, when I was younger, you know, my kid. So I started to just realize that this issue that sort of we haven't really been talking about is actually very alive under the surface. And I'm hoping that as we tour the film through Vermont, that we really start to have a conversation about this and are able to raise consciousness, because I think there are a lot of people out there that are suffering in silence. I think there are a lot of people out there that are scared that their kid has an eating disorder. I think there are a lot of parents who want to know, like our callers, how can I help prevent this? And so we all need to be talking about this together.
Filmmaker Bess O'Brien's latest project is called All of Me by Kingdom County Productions. It'll be shown around the state beginning next Thursday, and you can find a link to the schedule at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. And Bree Greenberg-Benjamin is a psychotherapist and founder of the Vermont Center for Integrative Therapy, which is featured in the film. I want to thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rick.
Coming up, new research could tell us more about the role phosphorus plays in those algae blooms in Lake Champlain. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. Algae blooms on Lake Champlain aren't just unsightly and smelly. They can be a serious health threat. So what the lake will look like in any given year is a question with big implications. And while it's clear that nutrients like phosphorus fuel the blooms, a lot is still unknown about how different conditions affect the extent of the cyanobacteria. Does it come down to how much phosphorus is coming into the lake through runoff? Or do the specific variations have more to do with climate? We're joined today by a scientist who has been researching these questions in depth, University of Vermont biogeochemist Andrew Schroth. Professor Schroth, I want to thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Rick.
So remind us of the basics of why nutrients like phosphorus are important to understanding algae blooms.
Well, nutrients like phosphorus are essential in understanding the blooms because they're essentially the food by which they live. It's like we need, as humans, food to survive, and algae are really the same way.
So they're we're feeding them with phosphorus.
Nutrients in ecosystems. They're present at low concentrations, and essentially, in the case of algae, limiting their density. And the idea is that in a system like Missisquoi Bay or St. Albans Bay, that is eutrophic or having these severe algal blooms, essentially, we've added more phosphorus to the system, which allows those nutrients to no longer limit the growth of algae.
And you're looking specifically at a relatively shallow part of the lake, Missisquoi Bay. Why is that?
Yeah, well, these shallow systems are actually very interesting, and the pollution problem is pervasive enough in that the algae can have access under certain conditions to the pools of phosphorus that are stored in their sediments.
So what have you found so far about the factors that have the biggest impact on algae blooms in any given year?
Yes, so that's actually a really interesting question. We know that essentially the root of the problem in these shallow systems, of course, is kind of a long legacy of phosphorus loading from the rivers. But what we find with the algae blooms in shallow systems like Missisquoi or St. Albans is that the duration and the severity of the bloom is actually much more controlled by the spring and the summer weather, which controls when phosphorus can be released by the vast inventory of reactive phosphorus, the legacy phosphorus that's stored in the sediments. Much of that sediment, or much of the phosphorus, is actually on the surface of a particular form of iron minerals, something very similar to rust you might see on your car, or the orange flocks that you would see looking at kind of groundwater seeps across the landscape. Those minerals tend to have a very high affinity for phosphorus when there's a lot of oxygen around. But what happens is when you have very calm weather conditions, so that the sediment is essentially not in contact with all the dissolved with the oxygen from the atmosphere, you're not getting the system well mixed, oxygen concentrations get very low at the sediment-water interface, so the interface between the water column and the sediment profile. And what that does is allows those minerals are no longer stable in that system, and they dissolve and, of course, release those that phosphorus into the water column. And, of course, because those systems are so shallow, the algae can then consume that phosphorus.
So you're saying climate has a major role in all this. So does that mean that we don't need to regulate runoff anymore?
Absolutely not. The research that we've been doing thus far on Missisquoi Bay suggests that you can't really do anything about that internal source before you do something about the external source. So the long-term legacy of nutrient loading from the Missisquoi River is the source of the problem, and until you get that under control, we're not going to make any progress. The problem with climate change more is that essentially, Lake Champlain as a whole is becoming, due to climate change, a more favorable place for these algal blooms to occur because of warmer water, less wind. In the shallow systems, we're generally seeing, when you actually mine a really neat data set that the Lake Champlain Basin Program maintains that goes back to the early 90s, you see that the lake's actually becoming calmer in the summer and it's becoming warmer. And these are conditions that both tend to facilitate more of that internal release and also facilitate essentially the cyanobacteria, the algal blooms that we're concerned with, outcompeting other species. And the net result is that essentially to get things under control, we have to work very hard to limit how much phosphorus is coming into the lake from these watersheds. And that becomes slightly also harder in the context of climate change because we're seeing more severe storm events in the region. And, of course, phosphorus is primarily associated with soils and sediment in these systems, so that when you get these stronger storms, you actually erode more sediment. So climate change makes the challenge more slightly more daunting, but also makes kind of our will to get in front of this more important. So we really need to work together, in my opinion, to limit how much phosphorus is going into the lake so that we can deal with, essentially, the additional challenges.
Is it clear to you how continuing climate change is going to affect those algae blooms in the lake?
In some systems, yes. We've part of the project that we're just finishing up, it's a Vermont EBSCORP-funded project, research on adaptation to climate change. We actually developed a model for Missisquoi Bay that allowed us to essentially project different climate change scenarios from regional climate down through the watershed and into Missisquoi Bay to look at how these blooms and phosphorus evolve under actual different climate change scenarios that are being projected on a global scale and in response to things like different future CO2 emissions. And what we find is that in general, over the course of decades, the blooms tend to get stronger and longer, and that there might be kind of thresholds where the blooms really take off under the really warm scenarios, where you're essentially increasing the window under the temperature window under which these blooms can really foster. And there's what we would refer to as a positive feedback loop, in that as the blooms get more severe, they can actually dissolve more of those minerals at the sediment-water interface, so they can kind of feed themselves over time if the conditions persist.
We only have a few seconds left, so this is a big question. But what are the biggest questions still out there about lake health and algae blooms that you want to work on answering?
There are a number of exciting new directions. We have two new grants that were just funded by the National Science Foundation, one of which was Vermont EPSCoR, where we're really going to focus in on understanding how these extreme events kind of cascade through the natural system from the atmosphere through the soil into the water and then into the lake, and how that will impact the system. And what components of the system essentially enhance resilience of water quality to those extreme events. And then the other research question that just a colleague of mine and I are after with another NSF grant is really understanding the nature of this iron-phosphorus interaction in the sediments of these water systems and how fluctuating conditions essentially either suppress or promote the reactivity of iron and phosphorus in these systems and how that could be used to both kind of suppress the algal blooms as well as potentially provide kind of an extraction scheme for phosphorus in these systems.
Fascinating
stuff.
A lot
of exciting work going on.
It is.
A lot of it here in Vermont.
Excellent. Hey, thanks for joining us. Andrew Schroth is a biogeochemist at the University of Vermont. And tomorrow, it's the 70s, a decade that changed Vermont profoundly and permanently. We'll look at the era of communes and the Back to the Land movement and how they reshaped Vermont. Were you part of that generation that moved to Vermont on a social or personal quest? If so, we want to hear from you tomorrow. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri, and thanks for listening.